This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 149.
I think in general, AI is going to augment all of our lives, both personally and professionally. I'm excited about that because I think this is a technology that should be crowdsourced about all the ways that it could be innovative and powerful. And I think that this is not the kind of tool where leaders are going to sit around a conference table in a C-suite and come up with the solution. So the best thing we can do is create the framework for intellectual property to be protected and have the safety and all the other pieces of the tool or tool set that your company decides to use, decide it. That's a good role for leadership. But then release the tool to the masses and see what they do with it, because they're the experts in those jobs. Back to that right side up company, like a frontline employee, somebody in accounting, somebody in the HR Global Service Center, somebody in sales, they know their job better than anyone else. And if we give them a set of AI tools, they could probably figure out how can those tools make them better in their job and also drive the advancement of the company.
How can AI unlock HR's potential? Why is it important that HR leaders are agile now and in the future? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversation, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. And with that, my guest this week is Christy Pambianchi. Christy serves as the Chief Human Resources Officer of Caterpillar Inc., where she's responsible for all aspects of human capital. Before joining Caterpillar in 2025, Christy served as CHRO for 18 years at various companies across multiple industries, and most recently was the Chief People Officer at Intel. She also held CHRO roles at Verizon and Corning, with responsibilities including information technology and every aspect of HR. Christy began her career at PepsiCo Inc., where she held roles in labor and employee relations, corporate organizational capability, and HR IT transformation. Christy serves on the board of the Lumina Foundation, and in 2017, she was inducted as a fellow of the National Academy of Human Resources, which is the highest honor in our field. It was such a pleasure to spend time with and learn from Christy as we discussed how her early career at PepsiCo taught her the importance of servant leadership and shaped her approach to HR, why it's important for an organization to stay focused and never lose sight of why they exist, why HR leaders need to be present and visible to build trust and hear real feedback from employees, why she's optimistic about AI as a tool for unlocking HR's potential, and we talked about her widely shared LinkedIn post, Letter to My Younger Self, and the five lessons she wishes she learned earlier in her HR career, and much, much more. I would love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Christy. Christy, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. I want to start by asking you about a pivotal experience you had early in your career at Pepsi. You described this as a breakout moment that helped shape your professional path. Tell us more about this important experience.
When I started my career at Pepsi, Pepsi had just bought back the franchise bottlers and a pretty good percent of them, and had a financial plan for what they thought they could achieve with the bottlers. And a few years into the mission, which is around the time I joined, they were doing a look back and realized they hadn't achieved the full financial objectives that they had set out to really dig into why. They formed an initiative called the Right Side Up Company. And I was literally in my first year of my career, and the whole effort was to turn the company upside down and be the right side up company and put the employees that made and sold the product and interacted with the customers at the top of every org chart. And the CEO and the COO put themselves at the bottom. And it was really a straight out of college introduction to servant leadership, how important it is that leaders realize our jobs are to unlock and make as easy as possible the work for the front line, who are the people actually inventing, making, selling the products. It really stuck with me from a values and a work approach standpoint and a massive corporate transformation so early in my career.
Wow. And tell me, what role were you playing on that project? I mean, I love the fact you guys kind of flipped that inverted pyramid, which is a lean principle. A lot of lean organizations do that as well with the employees who help the customers most. But what were some of the things you guys were doing there to bring that to life? Because that's easier than said than done, right?
Yeah. So I was only 1 year out of school and I was considered part of management, even though I was at a very, very entry level. And it was the first time I was really exposed to change management and change management thinking and theory. So they actually brought the top 6,000 managers together to a cascading session with the CEO and the COO, where they really charged us with this story about how we had to engage the employees in the change journey, why it was so important, that consumer habits were changing. There was an introduction of healthier beverages, water, teas, and we were going to partake in that, but it was going to transform the way we did everything in the company, from delivery to how we were going to organize the regional sales territories to how we were going to service customers. With that information, we were all sent back to our regions, and I was in the Northeast at the time, and my role was to work with the regional manager to really partner across the region with our frontline supervisors to bring this vision to life of how we would reorganize, how roles would change, what was the capability and the support that the frontline needed so that we could bring this right-side-up company vision to life. I was definitely at a low level where I was part of the team of people expected on the front line to bring that to life out in the field. It was very, very eye-opening to see the leaders, particularly the CEO and the COO at the time, Craig Weatherup and Brenda Barnes. They were so engaging as a very, very frontline supervisor myself, and the employees really had trust in them. They just were such great role models, and the experience I had as somebody very far downstream from them, but also interacting with the frontline trying to drive this change, it was really impactful to me about how much authenticity matters. And they were vulnerable. They talked about the business case that they had thought and that certain things had worked, but certain didn't, and why we had to transform. But also with an eye toward, we had to realize that the employees go in every day and service the customers, and that was going to be our differentiation versus the competition. It was a really great set of lessons I learned in my early 20s.
Well, and I think what is so incredible about that experience is you got to see the business end to end and really got to see leaders not only thinking about how to transform, but being open about the fact you need to transform. And you were pretty impressionable. So to see all of that and learn PepsiCo up front like that, what a great experience. Another defining moment you had was also when you led HR for Corning's optical fiber business. And this was actually during the dot-com crash, which included a collapse of the optical fiber market. So that was not an easy time to be a head of HR for a business unit going through that. But how did that experience shape your approach to helping organizations managing through disruption, and how did that impact you as a leader?
I joined Corning in the optical fiber business as the HR leader for the optical fiber business when optical fiber was sold out. And there was an insatiable demand for optical fiber. And there were at least two of the top strategic consulting firms, one advising our business team and one advising the board of directors as to what the outlook for fiber was. And in both scenarios, independent analysis was sort of a view that the demand for fiber was going to grow to infinity. Steel was going in the ground. We were adding factories. As I mentioned, we were sold out. We were the largest gate in terms of expanding the internet and the dot-com boom. As the dot-com crash started, we felt it first in our photonic business, and then it worked its way down into the fiber business. I don't think any of us foresaw how severe the correction would be. To give you a sense for that, Corning stock had gotten up to 300 in this really aggressive run-up at the peak of the dot-com expansion. We split 3-1, so the stock was 100. And by the time all of the dot-com crash was done, we were under $2 a stock. And we had to add shares to the company to pay off some debt that we had in order to stay solvent. I was very young. I was at this point just over 30 years old. And I got to experience the speed of growing up an S-curve and then the speed with which it came crashing down. Jamie Houghton came off the board to be the CEO and the chairman. He was one of the last founding family members. It's an over 150-year-old company. And he tapped Wendell Weeks to be his understudy and then take over as CEO. And Wendell had been my business lead in the optical segment. It was such an incredible learning because the first thing that the leadership team did, Jamie and his executives, was tell the organization, we will survive. That was the strategic plan. Everybody got buttons. There was posters all over. That's what we said externally. We will survive. It's a 150-year-old company, world expert in specialty glass and ceramics. That was the first calming effect for the people that were in the company, was like, okay, we're going to survive. And then second, Jamie said to his leadership team, you're going to do a teardown of how we got here. What did we miss? And then we're going to learn from that. I was not on the C-suite at that time. I was a director level employee, sort of a junior executive, but I was one or two rings of Saturn around it, orbiting it, watching it at the seat of the leaders doing it, and a sponge. The thing that came out of this deep analysis of how did we miss it? And again, as I mentioned, we had multiple top strategy firms doing independent analysis so that the board's CapEx decisions were informed by independent analysis. But when we boiled it all down to what did we missed three things. First is we had straight line thinking, which is what we called it, which sort of said, hey, we believed everything was going to grow to the sky. And there wasn't enough, almost like two-team approach of, okay, well, let's put the antithesis team together and tell them, but what if it didn't go like that? And actually charge an independent team with poking holes in the strategy. And then what were going to be all your risk mitigations if the other team was right? So straight line thinking was something we always then watched out for and started making plans that were most likely optimistic case, pessimistic case. The second thing was that we had, in the accelerating growth phase, we had taken on a lot of other side businesses, acquired some things, and we really sort of said, but we're not best in the world at those. We are best in the world at specialty glass and ceramics. And so it was a really interesting moment in time where I got to watch really difficult prioritization. And the lens for the prioritization was, what is your core and what is the reason you exist, and never lose sight of that. And I will say, over my 35 years, every time I'm in a growth period, I see how hard it is for the organization to stay focused and remember what its core is and not stray from that. And then the last thing was talent. The talent in the company had gotten very siloed, and each business had their own talent and planned for their own talent, and there wasn't talent sharing. There wasn't common standards for talent across the company. And there wasn't common awareness at the top level of who were the talent asset base of the company. So there were silos and people that were so-and-so's persons or so-and-so's team versus this is Corning's talent base and asset, just like you would think about your manufacturing asset base or your innovation IP portfolio asset base. I had the opportunity to not only contribute and see what they concluded from that, but then also be asked to lead the work for the leadership team on how they would make talent a strategic asset for the company. The humility with which the problem was attacked, and we went and told the story to all the employees in the company and to our various stakeholder groups, was something that always stuck with me.
That's a powerful story. It's a case study that could be a Harvard Business Review case study if it isn't already. But I love how you really just laid out what Corning did to continue to be an amazing company, even a near-death experience, which I did not know that Corning had at all. Didn't know that happened for them. What is sticking to me, two things. One, Christy, you have incredible business acumen. So I'm kind of curious and love to hear your advice on how you built your business acumen over the years, because it does take time. But two, really just understanding a company that can be that transparent. And then also the straight line thinking that we get into in HR. We start to believe a trend's going to continue. We don't think about what happens if it goes the other way or a black swan event happens. And how do we start preparing for that? And I think a lot of HR leaders could really learn from you in that way and say, well, wait, what are the intended, unintended consequences? What if we don't grow 10% next year? What if we grow negative 10%. What should we do? How would we think that through? And helping our leaders think that way, because we all have blind spots of optimism. Talk a little more about kind of the, I guess, how you've seen the straight line thinking help you in other approaches in HR. And then I'd love to circle back on business acumen.
One of the things that was so helpful when we surmised that that was a challenge, because I remember thinking, okay, but we had multiple independent analyses of the future, but we didn't have a team fully charged with saying, okay, but what if none of that is true? What would happen? So one of the things I have taken with me over time is to keep people around me that I task with challenging the status quo. And also, it's really easy on teams to put teams together with people that think alike. Group thinking. One of the things I really try to do is make sure when I build teams that there's different points of view on the team, because groupthink is the death of innovation. It's very human behavior to find the person that has that different point of view annoying to the team. They slow the team down. They don't necessarily agree with everybody. I think that's really important. So when I build teams, I build that into the team. And I learned that lesson from the leaders at Corning, who really strived to bring different voices to the table. So that's one thing that I've used to help with the straight line thinking. I also have tried, particularly you mentioned in HR, where people will jump on fad bandwagons or make this gear shift change because something is a trend or might be interesting for a particular moment in time. So I like to experiment. I like to innovate, but I also like longitudinal impact and impact over time that you can really measure. There's a balance there, because if you're going to try to measure longitudinal impact and be able to support how the talent outcomes have supported the business outcomes, you do have to leave some things the same so that you can actually track longitudinal data and have experimental outcomes over time. So I tend to like on those kind of trends that are emerging is find a pilot group, find a team, and really incubate it and see what those outcomes are. And if there are early adopters, if there's business units for which that makes a lot of sense, or a business leader for which this is something they're really passionate about, then that's a great place to marry a little bit of an HR innovation. And if it works, now you have that to potentially build from to scale it to your enterprise, versus starting out of the gates with, I'm going to enterprise-wide do some drawn out wholesale change that might be a flash in the pan or might not really work out. So I tend to encourage that. And maybe that loops around to knowing the business. So one of the things I think is really important is understanding what makes your business work, what makes it successful, what are the key differentiators that makes your company beat the competition. And then from that, extrapolate back from that, what role does talent play in each of those? Because that'll then really help you as an HR person say, well, if that's what differentiates my company, and then this is how talent affects the things that differentiate my company, how do I make sure my HR and my people work line up to make those things as impactful as possible?
I think that's brilliant. I really love this idea that groupthink is sort of the death knell of innovation, right? It's such an important point. And this idea of experimentation, having naysayers or having people on your team that say, hey, but what if this doesn't work? It's hard to have those critics sometimes, or people who are real truth tellers, because not every leader wants to hear that. But I think the decisions are better when someone says, well, what if it doesn't happen? Or what if we're all wrong? And start to play those games out. And I think that's really, really important for HR leaders to do that, because a lot of times our role is helping our leaders to forecast where things are going to go and how things will play out, because they're not always thinking about that in the moment. And that's our role to have a little more deeper thinking, bring it back and say, hey, let's have a conversation. Make sure we want to go this direction and we know what would happen if these other variables come to life. The other thing I'd love to talk to you about, Christy, is about a year ago, you wrote a post on LinkedIn, a letter to my younger self, 5 lessons I wish I'd learned sooner as an HR leader. It was a brilliant post. It had over 2,000 likes, 124 comments, 40 reposts. It's pretty fair to say it went pretty viral. Viral because you were really vulnerable to share this. And I thought it was a really interesting and great way to talk about for our younger selves. I think we always should give our younger selves advice. Talk a little more about why you wrote the letter and the advice you offer to your younger self.
I wrote this letter because, one, my children are becoming young adults and entering the workforce. And I also do talk to a lot of college students and young HR professionals. So it made me think, why don't I try to codify some of my thoughts as if I were presenting them to my younger self, because there was a lot of things I didn't know when I started working in my career, and I felt like maybe they'd be of use to someone else. A couple of things, I picked five. The first was really about knowing the business. And I talk a lot to young professionals or people starting their career that are thinking about where they want to get a job. And I talk to them a lot about, well, get to know that business. Think about that company. Think about their products. Do those things speak to you? What's their purpose? What's their why? And then what's the kind of workers that they have? And so do the talent challenges that that type of a workforce represents interest you? And if they do, that might be really great. And so I really find the first thing I talk with people about before any HR related items is really think about the business, the kinds of employees and jobs that are in that company, therefore the kind of people challenges that your work is going to get to work on. And for me, what happened was I started, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, at Pepsi, and I was super excited to start my career and I had my diploma and I was so proud of that. And the field commercial team I was embedded with, route salesmen, regional managers, sales folks, they said to me just straight to my face, "You're a waste of money. We would rather have a merchandiser." And I thought to myself, wow, okay, I really wasn't prepared for that. Never went through a case study on justify your existence as an HR person. And I knew the profession was continuing to evolve and become more relevant, but also right directly like that. And I was there, I was 21, 22 years old. The way I earned credibility with the teams I was in the field to support was because I learned the business. And I did that by riding routes. I would work a shift, you know, once a month in the warehouse when I was in a manufacturing plant, et cetera. On the regional team, I would really invest time meeting with various leaders and managers just to ask them questions about their work, about what made their work successful. How could talent play a role in that? I've taken that to every job because at the end, we're business people first and we want to make sure we really know the business. That leads to my second piece of advice. So for me, it was a gateway to credibility. And second, at this time, there was still a lot of dialogue, like HR has to know the business so HR can get a seat at the table. My second piece of advice was be an expert in your field. And the reason I say that is because I saw firsthand in the few of the early periods of my career, this huge pivot where we were trying so hard to be business people first, HR people second, like that HR person second was like almost like a subtext and you had to go looking for it. And my feeling is you're sitting at that table, you're on that business team as a member of the team helping run that business, and you are also the HR expert. To me, it's a shout out to have pride in our field and be an expert in it. My favorite baseball team is the Yankees, right? If you hired me to play right field, I want to be the absolute best right fielder and a great team member. For us in HR, we should bring our craft to the table. And a lot of the people we work with at the business table are really deep experts in their areas, and they know a lot about ours too. So we have to bring something above and beyond what a layperson would know, because this is our craft. And I also think it brings pride to our function. And I've always really wanted to have the employees on my HR teams be super proud of the fact that they're working in HR and know that we bring an expertise. That's why I say be an expert in your field. Some of my other advices to my younger self was to be present in the organization, to kind of loop back around to knowing the business, but in our roles as well, really being somebody that employees know, that people feel that they know you, they're going to trust you, they're going to give you feedback. Or if you seek out feedback, they may be more honest with you than they may otherwise be if you're just somebody that they don't know. So I always in my field locations would, you know, engage with employees, be in the parking lot, be in the cafeteria. Some organizations you can walk the floor, some you can't, depending on the operation, but you still want to be somebody that people feel they can approach. And that dovetails into living the culture. As HR people, we often help drive the processes to codify the values, scale the values, help the leaders in the company learn how to lead, living the values of the company. And we have to be the role model of that. Employees expect that of us. We have to expect that of ourselves. And then my last advice was just to find some balance. One of the things that's really hard in our jobs is saying no or finding just some time to break away and have some downtime for ourselves. I'm not always that great at that. And what I found was when I finally defined boundaries for myself, my team, my business partners, my bosses, they always respected it. And in the end, I was always the problem, not the organization. And so that's why I tell people, find balance, define what that is for you. Contract that with the teams you have, with the people around you. You'll be better at your job if you have time away and more perspective.
Excellent and timeless advice. And I think that last piece is interesting. A lot of times we are so focused on taking care of our leaders, the organization. We don't think about taking care of ourselves or setting those boundaries up. And then to your point, once you do, people go, oh yeah, those are really pretty reasonable. Sure. I won't email you at 9 o'clock at night or call you after nine on a Friday if you say, look, this is precious time for me and I'm happy to respond, but maybe a 24-hour response time or whatever that is. So really good advice. So, Christy, you've also talked about these four vectors of changing work, and one is this increased longevity, which a lot of us are saying, yeah, we're living longer, but you were actually saying, how can HR leaders prepare or rethink career paths if people start to live closer to 100 years, which is kind of becoming the norm? I mean, retirement is continuing to push out further and further. If you're healthy in your 70s, why not continue to work? So how do you think HR leaders should be thinking about this possibility that we might be living to be 100?
Yes, I'm really interested in this. When I was a student, life expectancy actuarial tables for males was in the late 60s and for females was in the low 70s. And now most of the actuarial tables are going to have numbers in the low 80s. That's for people working today. And if you look at people born today, their life expectancy is going to be much, much closer to 100. So I kind of think there's this moment where in the field of HR, in academia, studying the world of work, there's going to be a reimagination of what is a career if you are going to work over the arc of that kind of a lifespan. You're going to probably work 50 years. And I like to say, my dad's generation worked 30. I'm already 35 years into what will probably be a 45-year career. And my kids are going to be 50 plus. And so when I'm talking to students and they're like, what should I do? I said, well, you could probably do multiple things. Don't put so much pressure on yourself at 18 to have all the answers for the next 80 plus years of your life when you have so little life experience so far. That's kind of one of the first things that really struck me and made me start to have this idea. The other thing is I experience right now that there's a cohort in the world of people that are 55 to 75 that have finished the traditional 30-year career. And they're nowhere near ready to hang up their cleats or take a pause. There's this whole new nugget of people out there that are really kind of the first to probably be in that bracket where they have their health. They have all of the energy that they might have had to want to continue working. Their children are out of the house. They have the resources. We're learning by experiment as they happen right now out there. For organizations and for individuals, there's a couple of paradigms I think people have to think about, which is if you are going to work for 50 years, you will have to stay agile. And I know we're going to spend some time talking about AI today, but one of the things that's super interesting as well is over the arc of the last 150 years, if you think about the industrial innovations that happened with electricity and the period of time that it took for industrialization to expand, to the service sectors expanding, to globalization, to the digital revolution. Now we're in this AI revolution. The speed of them keeps shrinking. And so if you're going to work longer and the rate of innovation and change in the world continues to accelerate, people are going to need to be agile, stay continuously learning, learn new skills, not be afraid of the change because there is no world where change isn't going to happen and not going to happen more rapidly. So that to me is these trends that I think are super interesting.
It's really interesting. I mean, you kind of made me think about this. I'm waiting for the book to come out, The 100-Year Career. Maybe I should write this, but right, that it feels like a book right there because you're right. There's so many people that have had their career, the traditional career, and now they're starting over in that second phase, if you will, second half of their life to do things they want to do, maybe more aligned to their passion. But even if you are 25 years old, you're going to have multiple careers. Trying to figure it out, the only way is to stay curious and continue to learn and be flexible, which isn't always easy. But that seems like the only way to really survive in this crazy world that we're living in with AI and everything else. And you've also said AI is a disruptive force, which we think we all really agree with in terms of how we work and live. How do you specifically see that transforming the world of work and the HR function?
I've always been someone that loved technology, in full disclosure, JP. So I lived in a town that was near some tech companies. So in the 80s, they put computers in my grade school and middle school. I learned to code when I was 11 years old, back in BASIC. Nobody probably even knows that anymore. I've just constantly, whether it was in college or my internships or my jobs, my time as CHRO, really leaned into tech. And so now as I think about AI, I mean, I think it's amazing. And I think that it has the possibility to augment all of us. It's like we can have a work buddy that is helping us with tasks all day, helping offload some of the basic things that we might have spent a lot of time doing, and really allow us to find the time to do new things, new levels of analytics, new levels of insights, new levels of contribution. My kids have no idea how to do long division. I'm not sure they're better at math than me. So I'm not sure it was bad that they know how to use a calculator and do things that we had to do by hand. And there's going to be variations of that. All the things we could do in a spreadsheet now we're thinking about the analytics that AI can do, and that the data could be unstructured. Because we had spent a lot of time for years on data structures, data standards. That was a big part of having to get HRIS systems and analytics for people analytics to actually be meaningful, kind of garbage in, garbage out, if you can't analyze the data in a way that's consistent. And now AI and some of the data lake algorithm capabilities really poked holes in a lot of that, or just create a new capability. I think in general, AI is going to augment all of our lives, both personally and professionally. Civilization at large access AI at a rate that's faster than anything else, faster than the internet, faster than YouTube, faster than the television. So there's no way for companies to hide. People are using this in their personal life. And anytime things become a standard technology in people's personal life, they expect to use it at work. I was actually at a recent visit with employees in one of our locations, and they were saying, we want to use more AI tools in our jobs. And so employees are clamoring for this. And I was talking to shift workers. I was talking in multiple countries. I'm excited about that because I think this is a technology that should be crowdsourced about all the ways that it could be innovative and powerful. And I think that this is not the kind of tool where leaders are going to sit around a conference table in a C-suite and come up with the solution. So the best thing we can do is create the framework for intellectual property to be protected and have the safety and all the other pieces of the tool or tool set that your company decides to use, decide it. That's a good role for leadership. But then release the tool to the masses and see what they do with it, because they're the experts in those jobs. Back to that right side up company, like a frontline employee, somebody in accounting, somebody in my HR Global Service Center, somebody in sales, they know their job better than anyone else. And if we give them a set of AI tools, they could probably figure out how can those tools make them better in their job and also drive the advancement of the company. And so I like to say, how can AI help me out-invent my competitor? How can it help me do product development faster than the next guy? How can it help my operations have less break shrink or have less loss or be more efficient and effective than the competition? How can my sales team have more information at the ready about the customer set and have more customized solutions? So these are the ways I think about AI. And I think it is a little bit of a shame, JP, that the first sort of quarter in that big Q2 of 2023, when AI really exploded, some of the first narrative was it's going to wipe out jobs, it's going to replace X percent of the workforce, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's always what the narrative is with the new technology. And I just kind of look at it from the opposite lens of, no, it's going to actually take routine tasks, get them done at the fingertips of employees and talent, and it's going to give them the space to think of all these other amazing differentiating things that can make our companies win. If I think about it in HR, we've always said for decades now, employees own their own development. And I think things like AI and AI tools, or a coach for a supervisor, a coach for an employee, we've talked about on-demand training, on-demand work tools. And I think AI is going to be the closest thing to bringing that vision to life for people. So I'm very excited about that. And I think it'll just make us better as a profession, whether it's at real-time compensation analytics, market surveys are at least a year outdated. The trends in these tech labor markets move super fast. So my brain starts to go crazy on all the use cases. I think stay tuned. And I'm looking for my HR teams to really help drive how AI can help us do a better job. We're a very small and lean function in almost every company I've been at. I look at how AI can help our HR teams. Our HR teams have a lot of burnout, JP. They have been through a lot these last 5 or 6 years with some of the challenging world events and some of the things that were the tail impacts of the pandemic, and constantly being asked to do the same or more with less. And so I also am looking for AI to be a way that our HR teams can scale. And some of what happens to our HR teams, it isn't so much that they worry about picking up new work. They take really seriously not wanting to let employees down, not wanting to let a manager down. So when you can't get through your inbox and you can't answer every employee question, or you don't have time to explain the logic and the rationale for programs that were decided by leaders, like, that all weighs on the HR team. So I'm also hoping this is a tool set that can evolve to really help our HR professionals realize their personal and professional goals as well.
Yeah, I mean, there is so much happening in the world of AI. And I love your optimism, Christy. And I really love how you're thinking about flipping the narrative, because I think there are always going to be some fear of new technologies. And if you look back, actually, the Wright brothers, when we first got flight, it took 20 years later before the concept of Lyft actually was discovered. So my understanding, a lot of people, we really haven't figured all the use cases of AI. So I think letting people play, experiment, try new things. I think in HR, we're very early on those days. But to your point of personalization, augmenting work, helping people kind of supercharge what they're doing and do things better and faster, I think companies that really embrace that will get those advantages. And then over time, frankly, I think it'll be ubiquitous. I think every company will be using it. Some of these things will go away and not be a competitive advantage anymore, because they'll be using a lot of the same tools, right, as we get there. But it's really going to be interesting to see. Then the last piece, I guess I would say, I'd love your perspective, is that it just reminded me that we control the narrative. We get to change the future. It's not some kind of tidal wave coming down on top of us of AI. Our organizations and HR can play a real pivotal role in figuring out how do we bring this to our organizations and to our customers and what that looks like. So we need to keep agency, our ability to make change, front of mind as we do this. I did want to ask you, because you've been around HR and you've had some incredible experiences, is there a commonly held belief in HR that you think needs to be challenged as we move into this new era of work?
Definitely do. And there's probably many, but the one I'll highlight today is a lot of our talent systems and our HR systems have been built around the manager having a lot of control over an employee's career. Whether that's providing a talent rating, deciding whether they can transfer for a job, whether they're releasable, what programs they're enrolled in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, not taking anything away from how important a manager's role is. But I do think that in a lot of companies over the last 2 decades, spans of control have been really, really expanded. So managers may have 10, 20 direct reports. They may work in different geos. They may be running teams where people to complete their work are out with customers, out serving other people, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think we need to really reimagine that and give people a lot more agency over their destiny and the opportunity to advocate for themselves and have more open application for development opportunities and balance out that other perspective.
I think it's a really interesting perspective. You're right, because sometimes managers have almost too much control, right, to their own detriment, whether they know it or not, sort of just going, well, you're the manager, you get to make all the decisions for this employee or team member. We've seen that where people don't want to let go of their best talent or help them develop because that would impact their ability to deliver results. So I think it's really interesting and something hopefully will continue to shift. Christy, last question for you. What is one word or phrase you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Agile. And I know that's like an overused word. So I worked really hard on like, could I come up with something else? And I just kept landing on the same rock. The speed and the rate of technology and innovation around us is not just affecting HR, but it's affecting the companies we're in, the products that they make, the ways that they go to market, the way that they compete. There's a whole transformation happening as businesses try to compete in this new, continuing to evolve world. And that means that we have to be right there with them, thinking about what does that mean for talent? How does talent play a role in having a competitive advantage for your company? And so I think everybody in HR should feel really great about embracing change, being agile, finding ways to stay fresh.
Christy, thank you so much for being on the Future of HR podcast. This was a fresh conversation. I think it was agile and be really valuable to a lot of next gen HR leaders.
Thank you so much, JP. Great to be with you today.
Thanks again to Christy for sharing her insights about her amazing career and why agility and AI are the future of work. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter focused on helping you to elevate your career and business impact. Go to futureofhr.com to subscribe and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from over 100 HR thought leaders with simple, actionable improvement strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with another amazing guest, Mark Huslin. Mark is a distinguished professor of workforce analytics at Northeastern University and a partner at BHB Associates. He's the author of HR Scorecard, Workforce Scorecard, and The Differentiated Workforce. And in our conversation, we'll be talking about his latest book, Workforce Analytics, A Global Perspective. This is a great conversation with one of the premier experts in workforce analytics and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.